Welcome to Salon Talks. I'm Mary Elizabeth Williams, and I'm going to be honest, I'm having a huge fangirl moment right now because I am with Tina Brown. She is a legend. She's a one-woman award-winning industry. She's been the editor of Vanity Fair, The New Yorker. I'm just giving you the highlights here. The founding editor of The Daily Beast, she was the host of the talk show Topic A with Tina Brown. She's the author of the biography, The Diana Chronicles, The Vanity Fair Diaries, which is super dishy and fun. She's the founder of Tina Brown Live Media and Women in the World. I want to talk to you about Women in the World because that's incredible too. But her latest project is the Wondery podcast, TBD, with Tina Brown. It debuted just in December. She's already been talking to people like Aaron Sorkin, Allison Janney, Gretchen Carlson, the Gretchen Carlson one.
She was breathtaking.
Yeah.
She was so good.
She was so good. Well, you know, having two pros talking to each other, it was fascinating.
But she's doing amazing work, is the truth, because she's really taken forward her whole kind of crusade about sexual harassment, and she's taking it really to the blue collar workers, the women who just don't have any access to, you know, expensive lawyers or any kind of leverage, and she's really gone deep into that world, and it's an amazing achievement.
Right, she's really, and you've done some of that in your own career, but we're going to talk about that in a bit, but it's the way that she has, yes, is she's so present in the reality of the fact that she had a high profile case, she got a big settlement. Yeah. What happens to all those people who don't get
absolutely
it? And you've talked in that podcast about the repercussions for women.
Well, you know, the thing that I really was have been struck by in all of the noise, in a sense, and all of the exposés and all the scandals and so on, is that really you can't point to one woman whose career was improved by going public about being sexually harassed. Sure, they get a lot of exposure, or they may be asked on a lot of panels, or they could have their piece, you know, it written up. Are the actresses getting better parts now?
Right.
Are they getting more hired? Any of the women who've gone public about the way they were treated corporately, were firms jumping on them to hire them and say, this is a brave woman who spoke out, I'm going to hire her? Absolutely not. No, they become kind of poster women for sexual harassment, or they become toxic Marys who simply cannot get another job.
Right, either because they, and Gretchen talked about that, about how she, before she went public, she knew already that she would be considered damaged goods,
right,
going out there into the world. And what happens to women who don't have her power and her influence, you were talking about this, the women who say, I had a PhD, I was doing research, and now I can't find a place.
Right.
So the other side of that, Tina, is I want to ask you, what happens to the men? Because you have had a very long career in media. You have worked with or had some of these men refuse to work with you over the years. You've watched these men. What happens to them now? Is there a way for them to turn around? Is there a way for them to come back from this as well?
Well, it's interesting. I feel men are feeling quite raw, actually, at the moment, and threatened in a very deep way. I think that a great many men have felt before, this too shall pass. This is the latest kind of explosion in the culture, and things are going to, quote, go back to normal. But I think there's now a realization that this is truly the next big civil rights movement, that actually it isn't going to go back anywhere. It's only going to increase in momentum. Now, many, many terrific men are very pleased about that. They see, you know what, we were overprivileged and we have to make up for this. We were blind. We didn't realize what was happening. And I think there's a lot of men who honestly didn't know quite how bad it was amongst people they like and admire. You know, the good guys are thinking, oh my God, this guy's a dog and I didn't know it.
Gretchen Carlson said her husband didn't
even know. Yeah, absolutely. They really didn't. And but then there are others who think, you know what, my whole universe is getting shaken up here and I don't like it. And I actually had an encounter when I was attending the Davos Forum. We do an event there, and I was in Davos 2 weeks ago, and I made a joke in my opening remarks where I was interviewing Michelle Bachelet from the UN. And I said, you know, was it that she was president of Chile? And I said, was it your former career as a pediatrician that gave you such skill in handling the childlike nature of powerful men? Right? Laugh, you'd think. But afterwards, a major businessman was very upset with me. And he said to me, how come you can say that? And if I said that about a woman, I'd be killed. I'd be killed. I said, well, you know, actually jokes like that have been made about women for thousands of years. Mm-hmm. And it's like we're just having a little bit of levity. But he was very upset. And I realized, and he's a very good guy. So I think that he was feeling fingered, point sort of accused, and he clearly had a raw nerve in him, and that must be because there's a deep sense of anxiety about what has been going on.
Right, and when you haven't lived your entire career being the brunt of those kinds of comments, when you hear one for the first time, having it directed at you, you haven't developed that skill of like, maybe I can just back off. But you said something
about... Yeah, we're very good at laughing through gritted teeth.
Right, it's like, that's so funny that you said that. I'm gonna remember that now for a long time. You said something about a year ago that has really stuck with me, Tina. You said that Me Too, it's not just about sexual harassment, that it is about women feeling stalled and furious.
Absolutely.
And Tina, that phrase, I wanna get t-shirts that say stalled and furious, because that is so what it is. It's not just, I mean, the sexual harassment and the toxic culture is a big part of it, but the other part of it is just that feeling.
It's actually more overwhelming than the other sexual harassment part.
Just that
actually.
Air around you.
Yeah. Well, I just know so many women who feel that they just missed it every time. You know, that they had it all to offer, but they just were missed it every time. We were all pleased, I think, to see Susan Sarinsky get the presidency of CBS News, but it was like, oh my God, you know, she's in her 60s, and how many times, you know, how long had she been ready for that post? You know, for years she had been ready for that post. And I think that is really the major issue that women have. They feel that something about them, their presentation, whatever, that just has them kind of not quite getting what they felt was their due. And I think that does create a tremendous resentment. And that's why it's exploded like a kind of geezer coming out of a sidewalk.
Right.
In recent years, because the Trump thing was the kind of final straw, but it also just tapped into that waiting, fuming feeling that women have.
Right, it's that sense of when it's just there's just that straw. It's like when you're living with someone and it's just like it's not about the dish in the sink. It's about everything that led up to that moment. And you've certainly experienced that in your own career. And you've talked about how because you were in a position of leadership from a very, very young age in your career, the power dynamics were a little different for you than what you know other women have experienced. And yet you certainly experienced a great deal of scrutiny that I think some of your male colleagues did not, and you were written about and talked about in ways that men are not necessarily, especially because you have always, from the beginning of your career, Tina, included the people who fascinate you mm-hmm. in the publications and the projects that you've run. Mm-hmm. And you got crap for that.
I did. Well, it's very interesting. I mean, I you know, sometimes I read old clips because I'm in the process of researching something. And, you know, I have a wonderful podcast coming up with David Remnick, who I adore, who, you know, editor of The New Yorker, who succeeded me. And so there's a profile of David, who I adore, and who has done the most masterly job, and it's great. But then it described my tenure at The New Yorker. All right, so I came into The New Yorker, and it was in absolute, ailing beyond belief. It was, circulation was diving, and the demographics had got so old that the advertisers had all bailed. And so I let go 40 or 50 people, and I hired 40 or 50 people. And amongst the people I hired were Malcolm Gladwell, Jeffrey Toobin, you know, Ken Auletta, Jane Mayer, Anthony Lane, David Remnick, etc. Really completely changed blood, brought photographs for the first time, changed covers, complete blood change, okay. So it describes my tenure at The New Yorker this way. And then there was Tina Brown, who spent a lot of money, gave a lot of parties, and never published anything that wasn't something she could read on the Stairmaster.
Right.
And I thought, wait a minute.
That is how you've been written about, Tina. I went back and I was reading a lot of the stories that were written about you at the time when people were quitting.
You know, it's like, excuse me, this was what my nearly 7 years of intense hard work, you know, publishing pieces by, you know, 30,000 word pieces by Mark Danner about the murder in El Salvador. I mean, I published so much great work and I had a fantastic time and the editors and writers that I had are all still there now. But my tenure is written up, I spent a lot of money, you know, gave a lot of parties, and only published things she could read on the Stairmaster.
Listen.
And I just thought, it was an old clip, but I just put it down and I just thought, is it ever gonna stop?
No, and that is what I'm curious about, because if you've seen all of this and you've endured all of this, and yet you've also been able to, I think in a very classy way, Tina, create a space between your private life and your public life, and you have put boundaries around the way that you are spoken about, the way that you maintain these relationships with people you really do cultivate and care about. How do you do that? How do you navigate that in a way that is also when you know there are people talking smack about you?
Well, you know, I have actually never bothered about it, and I mean, my passion is for really smart, interesting people and a whole eclectic mix of them, and I think somehow maybe that is one of the things that people have never really understood. How can I be so interested in people from culture or Hollywood or whatever, but at the same time, you know, on my podcast, my most exciting guest to me so far has been Steven Greenblatt, who is the Shakespearean scholar and professor at Harvard, who wrote this wonderful book, Tyrant, about Shakespeare's tyrants and how they relate to the Trump era. That's what I'm interested in, right? So I've always had that marvelously kind of curious temperament, if you like, that allowed me to delve deep in all these different worlds. But I think there is something incredibly threatened, I don't know, about the whole idea that somehow if you're a serious person, you're only interested in this small narrow thing, and you have to look a certain way, be a certain way. And frankly, women just get belittled. I mean, it's like, you know, I'll never forget when I ran, when I won a General Excellence Award at Vanity Fair, it said she brought buzz and fizz and made me sound like a cheerleader, you know? And it's, you know, this was an issue where I'd published, you know, William Styron's 10,000 word essay on depression that became his book and called it Darkness Visible after a poem by Milton. Okay, that was what we were doing.
It's not Stairmaster reading.
Yeah, I mean, it was like, okay, and I published tons of great, you know, Demi Moore pregnant, but the whole mix was there. But it's just, I really believe that if I'd been a male editor, that perception would not have been narrated in that way. It would have been, you know, he has brought to Vanity Fair, a cultural range that, you know, it would have been that write up. And so I just have got used to that over the years. I mean, I have honestly now just got used to that narrative, and I just blaze on. But just once in a while, like about every 3 or 4 years, I'll stop and I'll read something and I'll think, wow. It's like, what does it take? Being dead 25 years? Or is it just this is what it's going to be?
Right. Well, you were young, you were ambitious, you were smart, you were blonde. Those are not, you were female. Those are not elements that the publishing world has necessarily been used to.
I don't know. I definitely think it's the female issue. I truly do. I mean, I do think that if you're a woman, you have to be gold in a silver job. That's period.
I think that's exactly it. Do you think that's changed?
Not really.
I want to ask you. Yeah. Do you think that it's different now for other women coming up, especially because the way that the narrative works now in journalism is so different? And if you are a young person and a rising star in the media, you are expected to be on social media. You're expected to be tweeting all the time. You're performing your career in real time in public. You are potentially making your mistakes and your foibles in real time. You are not able to have that quiet drink in the back room that maybe would have existed a few years ago. How does that change it? And how does it change it especially for women?
Well, look, I mean, I just completely applaud, you know, the women fighting back over these issues. It's desperately needed. But, you know, Nikki Haley was actually a very successful UN ambassador, in my judgment. And okay, it's Trump. We don't expect anything more from him, perhaps. But when I read, you know, she brought glamour to the job, I felt that rage all over again. Mm-hmm. I know that Nikki Haley will never speak about that. She's way too deft and so on. But here's a woman who has done her job with great sort of appropriateness and judiciousness and success and then resigned. She brought glamour to the job. So, okay, so now the sort of the younger brigade who are, they're sort of almost embracing maybe that. I mean, I think that they're just sort of perhaps able to be more open about the various sides to their personality. They're less uptight. There's no doubt that the younger leaders are less uptight than the others. I mean, in Britain, for instance, there's an amazing leader of the Scottish Tory party, Ruth Davidson, her name is. She's a... She's a 40-something kickboxing lesbian who married her partner on the trail, and she's ferociously funny on Twitter. And she is like a 10-year, you know, she's a different generation, say, from Theresa May, who's much more what I would call in the Hillary Clinton mode. So I think that older women are much more guarded on the whole, because they've had so much to defend. So maybe the younger women's sort of social media ubiquity is going to help women be able to kind of shed so many of the different stereotypes that they've felt that they're forced to live inside.
Right.
And it might help to change that.
You see these millennial leaders, who female leaders in Congress, who are saying, like, yeah, I will talk about my lipstick shade.
That's right.
And it doesn't diminish me.
That's right.
In my leadership capacity. And
I like that.
Yeah.
I think it's actually very healthy and very good.
Well, it's the conundrum that women in the workforce have felt for so long, right? It's do you go on the path of trying to be as masculine as your coworkers, or do you deviate from that and express femininity? And then either way, you're screwed.
Well,
right?
Yeah, every way you're screwed. I mean, I think it only works if you. It takes a lot of confidence to be able to do that, and you know, I think it's actually a good path to blaze. I actually do like Cortez's ubiquity. I think it's very refreshing.
I like that she drives people crazy.
I love it that she drives people crazy.
She just comes back for more. So Tina, you love talking to interesting people. You love talking to the people who fascinate you. And when I listen to the podcast and I see the kinds of lineups that you have for Women in the World, it's very different. You are really branching out. You are not just talking to celebrities. You're talking to people who are fighting against human trafficking, who are working against war crimes. How has your path changed? I mean, not that you haven't always been engaged.
Well, I've always had a very sort of gritty side to my journalistic sort of menu, if you like. I mean, those stories have actually always been in The New Yorker, Vanity Fair, The Daily Beast. I've always done that and wanted to have that mix. And as a matter of fact, Women in the World follows very much the sort of what I think of as the pagination of a magazine. I mean, we'll start with a very gritty discussion, like, we were actually ahead of all of the Me Too. Gretchen Carlson did her sexual harassment panel with us, with a firefighter who'd been sexually harassed and a lawyer telling the audience how they could actually beat the system and get compensation. So you might start with a gritty conversation like that, then you'll go to a really powerful human interest story. I mean, last time we had an incredible Australian sea captain who rescued migrants from the Mediterranean. Okay, so you'll go to that, the sea captain. And then the third thing might be Scarlett Johansson. But that's really, to me, is the sort of the secret sauce, if you like, of all the magazines I've done, and also of Women in the World, because what I'm trying to do is seduce into caring and being interested in all kinds of story. And if you put it together like that, you know, you will actually find that people will then sit and listen to the very story that they might have turned over or not read or thought, sounds a bit earnest, I'm going to go to go out and network during that. They actually don't, because they're sort of held by the changes of pace. And what excites me in the intervals is when I hear people saying, as they're lining up, you know, for the ladies' room, they'll say, oh my God, I never knew that was happening in Syria. Like, oh my God, that woman, you know, from Uganda, I didn't know about this horrendous stuff that was going on. I mean, like, the girls that came back from the Lord's Resistance Army, like, what? I never thought about whatever happened to those girls or whatever, you know. And that is, I think, a really exciting thing to be able to do, because it's kind of, it's giving people keys to new worlds. And as someone who's a bit of a sort of discovery junkie, I mean, a kind of, you know, I'm very voracious for information about things I don't know about. And interested in the other. I've always been really interested in the other. You know, what is it like to be this person, this girl who was stolen by Boko Haram, or this extraordinary, you know, woman who has, you know, I don't know, helped start the Liberian Revolution, and here she is sitting on my stage. That's always really been very interesting to me. And yet I can also deep dive into, you know, a movie star's issues. I mean, I'm not patronizing that movie star. You know, I find it interesting. I mean, her world is also interesting. It's not my world, but it's completely different from the one I was just talking about. But it has its very interesting side. So I think that it's a kind of, I guess, a Catholic taste that I think everybody has in a way. I mean, I think people can be seduced into reading and looking and listening to things that they didn't think they were interested in. I mean, you know, the old Diana Vreeland maxim at Vogue was show them what they never knew they wanted, right? And that really is what an editor should be doing, is like not just following what readers tell them to run, but actually saying, no, you're interested in this, but you promise me trust me, and I'll tell you how interesting this is. Which is actually why I get kind of irritated sometimes with the Netflix algorithm, because it was like, because you watch this, you'll be interested in this.
Right.
No, I won't.
Right.
I'm actually really bored by this. I don't want to see another noir Danish thriller just because I really loved that one. Actually, I'd like to see something completely different.
I was like,
I've just ordered a divorce in Manhattan.
You know? Right. I've just ordered a vacuum. Don't you? Because you bought a vacuum. Don't you want more vacuums? No, I'm kind of.
I'm done.
I'm set for vacuums for a while, right? But that is a hard thing to trust and be confident in the media to do, because we are such a short attention span culture, and you know that people are maybe just reading the headline, and if you don't get it clickbaity enough, right, that they're going to move on to the next thing. And to have that, but yet you've got the track record that shows this is a way of developing engagement and curiosity. Because it's infectious, because it's your curiosity that's leading it. So I want to ask you before we go, because I've only got one more question I can get out of you. You've been doing this so long. You've been a professional conversationalist for so long. What is your idea of a great conversation? Mm. Tina, when you sit down and you walk away from the table and feel like, wow, I learned something, I felt something. What are the elements for you, for all of us who want to have deeper conversations in our lives?
Ideas. Most of all, ideas. You know, I want to talk to people of ideas with ideas. I want to hear about who we are, why we are, where we're going. That's what I most love. Someone who can give me a view, an insight, an enrichment on that. Answer the problems of our times. Because right now we're in a time of so much confusion, so much anxiety. Anyone who can offer me rich insights, which is why I love talking to the Shakespeare scholar Greenblatt about Shakespeare's tyrants, because, you know, I'd never thought about the Trump era from the point of view of Richard III, if you like. I mean, that this actually has repeated again and again, and that all the same things, all the same social factors that threw up tyrants over the years are reproduced again and again. You know, an unhappy populace from a bad economy, a decay of truth, a sense of disappointment and being let down, and a desire for magical thinking. All these things are repeated again and again, and we see it again in Trump. So what does that mean? Where are we going now? That's the kind of conversation that makes me feel, at the end of it, really enthralled.
It's, as a listener, right there with you. Tina, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
The podcast is called TBD with Tina Brown. It is addictive.
Oh, thank you. It is
completely fascinating.
Well, it's my new medium. It's one thing I hadn't done. I thought, you know, I've done magazines, I've done digital, I've done, you know, but this was something new to conquer.
now you just have to, do a vlog, and you're all good to go.
Please,
Tina,
no more.
It's so fascinating.
Thank you, Mary Elizabeth, and I'm dying to read your book.
Oh, okay.
Which we chatted about ahead of time.
Yes, I have a book too. You can read mine.
Yes.
I love it when you promote.
Yeah, let's
other
plug
people.
Your book.
And you can also find her at the Women in the World. It's coming in April.
April 10th anniversary, April the 10th. Lincoln Center, 10th to the 12th. We have an incredible lineup, and it's, you know, the theme this year is Can Women Save the World?
Let's try, right?
Because those guys have made a hell of a mess of it.
Now we're going to take a crack at it. Tina, thank you so much. It's
a pleasure. Thank you, Mary Elizabeth.